2012, February 24th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 35, Exoplanets, Planets Around Other Stars. Today on this wonderful Friday afternoon here at Ohio State, we're going to be finally getting down to the point of this course. In that, we're looking for life on other worlds, ultimately, life in the universe, and we need to find other planets. What we'll be starting is a two-part lecture. Today, we'll be talking about the techniques we use to find and identify exoplanets, planets around other stars. Monday, we're going to talk about what we've actually found in detail. We can't look at all of them because there's way too many of them, as it happens. But we'll look at some of the highlights of the searches for exoplanets, and we're starting to narrow in on actually finding Earths, hopefully in the habitable zones of their parent stars. But today we want to talk about the various methods we use to search for these planets. So we're going to be reviewing the basic types of detections. The first and most obvious of these would be take a picture, see a planet around another star. That's called direct detection, and we're going to see that's extremely challenging. But it is just becoming possible now with some new technologies that have been developed, both from the space and from the ground. Most of the methods we're going to use, however, are going to be indirect methods. We're not going to see the planet itself, but we're going to see the effects of the presence of that planet on some aspect of the parent star. We call these indirect methods. So otherwise, the planet's kind of invisible to us. We're going to see, for example, that radial velocities, the introduction of a wobble into the star due to the gravity from its host planet, and transits, those rare cases in which the planet passes between us and the star and gives you a little dip in brightness, are very, very successful methods. In fact, most of the planets we know of have been discovered by either the RV method or the transit method to date. And we'll say something about those in a second. There are other methods. For example, gravitational microlensing and, to a lesser degree, direct imaging are finding an increasing number of interesting planetary systems. Gravitational microlensing is a very indirect way of finding planets. We're finding them by their gravity, in this case, their gravity signature on light. I'm going to mention this in some detail because this is a method that we've pioneered here at Ohio State. And to date, we've found about a dozen systems using this method, some of them quite interesting. The bottom line, however, is there is an exoplanet encyclopedia online that keeps track of this particular game. As of Valentine's Day, February 14, 2012, we now have reasonably good detections of 760 planets around 609 stars. The mismatch for that should tell you that we're finding increasing numbers of multi-planet systems. Now, the details of what these planet systems are like is what we're going to talk about on Monday. But we've literally, since the late 1980s to the present, have gone from zero planets around stars other than the Sun, the only system we knew of was our own, to now vastly outnumbering our solar system and a vast number of stars. So we're beginning to really come to an understanding about how often planets appear around other stars and what their properties are. And this is really changing this whole game. It's one of the reasons why this class even exists, because now we can really sensibly talk about planets around other stars and the possibility of life around other worlds, on other worlds around other stars, using real data, not just science fiction speculation. So that's the real, this is why it's getting around to the real meat of this class. So there's two basic ways to play this game, two basic methods we can use to look for stars around other planets. The first one is just, like I said, the obvious one, direct detection. You take a picture of a planet orbiting around another star. You just beat away at the star, and you notice little dots of light orbiting around that star. That's really hard. The other are going to be indirect methods. We look at orbital motions. Objects orbit around a common center of mass. So the planet's gravity will actually cause that star to wobble. We can't see the planet itself. It's invisible to us. It's maybe hidden in the glare or too far away to see. But it has the gravity of that planet has an effect upon the motions of the parent star. It causes it to wobble back and forth. And there's various ways we can exploit that wobbling motion to actually note the presence of the star by that gravitational response. That's going to be very successful. The other thing that can happen is occasionally we expect that the planet's orbit and the star are exactly lined up with our line of sight. And occasionally the star gets sort of a micro eclipse by the planet. We call that a planetary transit. And the light will dip a little bit because some part of the star's face is being blocked by the planet. We can actually see that. We see that in our own solar system with the planets Mercury and Venus are occasionally transiting the Sun as seen from the Earth, we can use this more generally. This is a technique that was kind of accidental up to a few years ago, but there's a dedicated space mission now, as we'll see, called Kepler, that is actually discovering an extremely large number of these. They've got almost 200 confirmed planets by the transit method, but they have 1,000 or more candidates. And finally, gravitational microlensing of the background star by the planet. The planet has a little bit of gravity. Gravity, as Einstein tells us, causes light to bend. So if the planet passes exactly between us and not the parent star but a background star, that background star will slightly brighten a little bit. It's like passing a little lens across the sky that reveals the presence of that planet around the lensing star. It's a much more abstract effect, but it actually turns out to be a very good method. Andy Gould and Scott Gowdy here at Ohio State on the faculty have been pioneering it. I've been a member of the micro-lensing follow-up network team that's actually used this method successfully over the last decade to discover 12 planetary systems, including the first solar system analog found outside of our own. So let's go through each of these methods and just some basic results to give you an idea how all these things work. This is a really exciting time for exoplanet studies because we've gone from zero to a tremendous amount of knowledge. And this has gone hand in hand with a number of advances in technology. We couldn't just use the same old techniques to play this game. We had to invent literally whole new bodies of technique to solve the very, very challenging problem of seeing little tiny faint planets next to their very bright stars. Stars outshine their planets by huge factors. Hundreds of thousands or even millions or more, depending upon the size of the planet. So it's really hard. You're basically looking for a little tiny firefly against a really big searchlight. And you've got to do that. It's with ground looking up either from the ground through the wobbling atmosphere or using a space telescope. It's extremely challenging. So that glare is what we've got to knock down. So one of the tricks that's come up lately is using a technique called coronography. It was actually invented for looking at the sun. The idea is it's sort of analogous to, I want to look out there and there's a really bright light at the background and all I see is the glare. What's our response? We put our hand up to block the source, the light source that's too bright to see in the distance. So for example, if you're standing outside on a sunny day, say towards sunset or sunrise, and you're looking in the direction of the setting sun, you kind of glare it out, so you put your hand up and you block the sun, and then it makes it easier to see the various things that would otherwise be lost in the glare. Well, that's what this trick does the same thing. We use a little disc inside the camera to block out the star, and then use some tricks to detwinkle the atmosphere, called adaptive optics, to make that star's image as small as possible, so it isn't twinkling and running around. And hopefully, by knocking down the light and controlling the glare that goes into our telescope and camera, can actually pick out the little faint planet around what would otherwise be completely obliterated by the glare of the star. We are literally looking for a firefly against a searchlight. And the question is, how do we put our hand in front of the searchlight and then spot the little blink of the firefly? So here's an example of this. It's very, very hard. Okay, let me back up a little bit. It's so hard that to date, only 27 planetary systems for a total of 31 planets have been discovered by this method, despite tremendous effort. It's probably the most challenging method to date, but it's also the one that people are pushing on hard because it's one thing to see the gravitational presence of a planet. We love pictures. We'd like to get a picture. And the ultimate goal is to get a picture of that little blue dot, a little Earth-like planet around a sun-like star in its habitable zone. We're not there yet. We're not seeing little blue dots yet, but we are seeing giant gas planets, Jupiters, or actually, really, to be more to the point, super Jupiters. So here's an example. This is a star in the southern hemisphere called Beta Pictoris. It's a very, very bright star. Beta pretty much tells you it's the second brightest star in that constellation of Pictor. It's been known for a long time that Beta Pictoris had this massive disk of debris around it. It actually, when you took pictures of Beta Pictoris, it had a signature of infrared radiation coming from this disk. And then when you did old school coronography, which wasn't very good in the old days, you could see the disk of material. This is a fairly young solar system, and you're still seeing some of the construction debris left over. Well, it turns out there are some gaps and wiggles in the Beta Pictoris disk that gave people an idea that one of the ways you can make those gaps and wiggles is if there's a planet clearing out the stuff, just like we think the way planets formed in our own solar system. So very recently, European team using one of these coronagraphs, using this advanced adaptive optics system, which basically fires a laser up through the atmosphere and tries to figure out how the atmosphere is twinkling. And then you have another mirror that you push and pull to detwinkle the atmosphere. You kind of catch the distorted waves coming down from the twinkling atmosphere, and you detwinkle the stars. It's a marvelous new technique. And it works quite well. It's not perfect, but it works very well. It allows you to make the star image shrink down smaller and smaller. You reduce the amount of glare from the atmosphere, and sure enough, there is Beta Pictoris B, just barely shining out to one side in the general plane of this what's called a debris disk around this star. So that's an example of direct detection. And there we kind of had a hint that there should be something there and an idea of where to look. Sometimes it surprises us. This is the first multi-planet system that was found. It was found a couple of years ago with three planets, and more recently now has been shown to have four planets around it. It's a star called, BS9167 or something like that. I'm always forgetting the names of these things. There's so many of them now. And they have really boring names. They have catalog names. So here is where the central star has been obliterated by this coronagraph effect. This is using the giant Keck telescope up on the big island of extinct volcano on the island of Hawaii, Mauna Kea, using one of these so-called adaptive optic systems. And they see one, two, three, four planets. The first three, B, C, and D, were seen a few years ago, but recently they've improved the techniques of detwinkling the stars here, revealed this inner planet E. The arrows here indicate 10 years of orbital motion predicted for these objects. And in fact, because it's been seen over many years, all of these objects have been seen to move a little bit in their orbit, all clocking in the same direction. So that's one of the other things that you get out of the direct imaging, is ultimately we can map out the orbits of these. If you can map the orbits, that means you can measure their masses, which is very important. Of course, what we find in the case of all of these is they're all super Jupiter size. Some of these are up to about 15 times the mass of Jupiter. So this is a system. It's around a relatively nearby, I think it's a K. See, this is a funky star. It's actually an F star. So it's a little bit hotter star than the Sun. But it's got a very, very large system of super Jupiters. In fact, at least one of these, probably, it's either C or D. I always forget which one is which. May in fact not be a giant gas planet, but actually a failed star, a thing called a brown dwarf, an object that never got big enough to ignite hydrogen fusion in its core. We're going to be arguing over this particular system for a very, very long time, but this shows you what the promise of these brand new technologies is for direct detection. Super challenging, super hard, and we're primarily sensitive to super giant planets, meaning big gas giants. So we're not going to find Earths by this technique yet. The trick is going to be to apply this technique from spacecraft, and there are a few to get above the atmosphere. And then when you're deglaring the star, when you're detwinkling the system, what you're really taking out is optical imperfections in your telescope that can produce problems. And so the real challenge is going to be getting it down to the point that we can search for Earths. Probably what people are going to do is use one of the other techniques, like transits or radial velocities, if it gets to that point, to detect the planet presence by other means, and then apply this very expensive direct imaging technique to try to get a picture of it. And the ultimate goal is not just to get a picture, but as we'll see in the coming week, to actually try to get a spectrum of it to see if it in fact is a harbor of life. And certainly, if we ever discover Earths or slightly bigger than Earth planets in the habitable zones of their parent stars, then the high cost of these techniques in terms of time and expense to build the instruments will become fully justified. In fact, we'll be falling over ourselves to try to do it. That's the future, though. How do we discover most of those 790 systems? Well, we do that because of the fact that planets are orbiting stars. And what Newton told us was, in fact, that planets don't orbit around the center of the star, but the star and the planet orbit around their common center of mass. You think of it as kind of like a balance beam with an unequal set of barbells on it. I got a 25 kilo weight on one side and a 5 gram kilo weight on the other. The balance point is going to be closer to the bigger weight. We've all played the game of balancing two things on a stick at some level. Simple scales work that way. Works the same way for stars and gravity. So I have a gas giant planet here, and a circling a star. Now, I've exaggerated the mass ratio so it's visible. The center of mass in this particular system is actually inside the star. So what I would see from the outside is the star is on a smaller, slower orbit. The planet is on a bigger, faster orbit. Now, they both complete one circuit in, say, oh, I think I've set this thing up to be about 3 seconds. But because the planet's out on the big arm, it's going over a big circle in 3 seconds, so it's moving really fast. The star is closer to the center. It's going on a small circle at a much slower speed. The speed ratio between the planet and the star is just their mass ratio. So if the planet was 1/1000th the mass of the star, the ratio of the speeds would be 1 out of 1,000. The star would be moving 1,000 times slower than the planet is in its orbit. Well, the problem is this. We can't see the planet. It's too faint. But I can see the star just fine. So I'm going to be looking for a very, very small wobble. Either a small wobble in speed, which I can measure with the Doppler effect, or I'll be looking for a small change in the position of that star against background stars. So, for example, if I'm looking down upon one of these systems, I'll see that star wobble around like this, except I won't be seeing the planet. I would just see the star kind of jiggering around in a simple regular pattern. That's if there's one planet. If there's two planets, it moves around the common center of mass of all three bodies, and so the pattern might be a much more inelegant and complex dance. For example, let's take a multi-planet system we know real well, our own. What if we were sitting out from the outside, maybe 18 light years away? That's a relatively nearby sun-like star. Let's imagine that that star is inhabited, and those astronomers are searching for life around nearby stars, and they point to our sun. Well, the two biggest planets in our solar system are Jupiter, 318 times the mass of the Earth, and Saturn, at 95 times the mass of the Earth. The combined motions of the Jupiter-Saturn-Sun common center of mass between 1919 and 2020 will look something like this. It will do this kind of jigger and jog dance because of the combined gravity of Jupiter and Saturn on different parts of their orbits. But look at the scale here. From the center of the apparent sun to the outermost edge of this orbit is less than 1/1000th of a second of arc. A complete circle is 360 degrees. Each degree is subdivided into 60 minutes of arc, which each minute is then subdivided into 60 seconds of arc. So 1 second of arc is 1/3600th of a degree. I'm now going to subdivide that by another factor of 1,000. That's really tiny. And that's part of the problem. What we call this astrometric wobble, the apparent motion wobble of the position of the sun against the background stars due to the fact that it's not sitting still all by itself in space, but it's moving around the common center of mass, in this case, of the Jupiter-Saturn system. All the other planets in our solar system, they're just junk. They don't really add to this anything measurable. So if we combine the Jupiter-Saturn-Sun motion, it's really going to be tiny. And this is what we would see if we were 18 light years away. We go 36 light years away, it's half that size because it's further away. And so this is an extremely challenging way to find this wobble due to the stars, this indirect motion. I can't see Jupiter and Saturn, but I could see the motion of the sun. Challenging, but not impossible. There's a new space mission being put together primarily by the Europeans called Gaia, which is going to be an extremely accurate way of measuring the angular positions of stars on the sky. Its goal is really to map out distances and motions of most of our local galaxy for stars. But one of the side effects of that is going to be for nearby stars, it can search for this astrometric wobble effect and probably find giant gas giant planet systems around relatively nearby stars. We think in our own solar system, we know that the gas giants formed along with the rocky planets. So if you find a system with gas giants out kind of in the rough positions of Jupiter and Saturn, it's a reasonable bet that might be a place you would then concentrate on to try to find rocky planets on the inside. So this astrometric wobble technique, which is interesting, no one's ever made a movie of this. I've been looking all over for it. I've asked my colleagues about it. They don't know why. But this astrometric wobble technique should work, but it's going to be challenging. But it's another way to do this as an indirect method. So that's one way of just seeing the thing bounce around in space. Really hard. But there's another way that I can see the motion of the star due to the presence of the gravity of a planet around it, and that's by using the Doppler effect, or what we call the Doppler wobble or radial velocity, shortened to RV method. Here we're going to be exploiting the Doppler effect in spectroscopy to measure the speeds. The Doppler effect is actually really easy to use. Okay, so I got a pair of a planet circling around a star. Now I've exaggerated the center of mass. I made a very, very massive planet and a little tiny star to exaggerate the center of mass distances. Let's say I took a snapshot. So I'm looking at the system more or less edge on like this, so that I alternately see the star coming towards me and moving away as it orbits around. When the star comes towards me, the Doppler effect tells me that all the spectral lines in the star that I see, all the spectral absorption lines, will be shifted slightly towards blue wavelengths. So this is the spectrum of the star. I've actually picked out a nice A star here with hydrogen lines. The dashed line is where those lines would appear if the star was not moving at all relative to me. But because it's moving towards me on its orbit, the lines all shift to the blue. If I wait half a period later, the star is now moving away from me, and the Doppler effect tells me the lines will shift to the red. So if I watch this over time, what I'll see is I'll see the spectral lines kind of wobble back and forth. This can be done to absurd precision. For example, the little microwave or laser-based gun that the cop has standing on the side of the road, sitting there watching people's speed, he's using the Doppler effect. It transmits a signal at a given wavelength. It bounces off your moving car. The reflection, because it's moving away, slightly blue shifts. Or if you're coming towards them, the reflected signal slightly red shifts. We can measure those shifts to exceedingly high precision, many, many orders of magnitude. That's how something moving as slow as a car, or even a person or a baseball, we can measure its speed by using the Doppler effect. So what we're doing is we're basically applying a kind of telescopic traffic gun to the stars. And we're not just measuring its speed, but we're measuring how the speed changes periodically. What I'll see is a very distinctive signature of sometimes moving towards, sometimes moving away, sometimes moving side to side when there's no shift at all. And I'll see a very particular sinusoidal shift. The magnitude of that shift tells me the speed. So we can actually measure both the orbital speed and its period. The star is too far away. The seeing is too poor. I can't get fine enough pictures. So I don't actually see the star jiggering back and forth. I don't see the planet. But I see the combined orbital motion of the planet and star basically imposed as a Doppler signature. So we call this the Doppler wobble or radial velocities technique. Now let's get an idea of what these numbers are like. The bigger the mass of the star makes its orbital speed very small. Right? The star always outweighs the planet. So even though the orbital speed of the planet's really big, it's that star speed we're trying to measure, because we can't see the planet at all. So let's again take the example of the Sun and Jupiter, a system we know very well. Jupiter's orbital speed is 13 kilometers a second. Turns out that Jupiter is about 1/1,000th the mass of the Sun, so the speed of the Sun will be smaller in proportion to the ratio of the planet to star mass. In this case, the motion of the Sun will be 1/1,000th of 13 kilometers a second, which is 13 meters a second. That's only 30 miles an hour. That's actually pretty measurable, as it turns out. If, however, we go to the Sun and the Earth, I don't want to find Jupiter's, but I want to find the Earth. Well, the difference in ratio between the Earth and the Sun, the Earth is tiny compared to the Sun. So while the Earth is going around at a screaming 30 kilometers every second in its orbit, the mass ratio makes the Sun go back and forth at 10 centimeters per second. 10 centimeters per second is this fast. So the Sun is wobbling back and forth as fast as my one hand is moving back and forth, and I'm trying to move 10 centimeters a second. A foot per second, no, actually it's a third of a foot per second. It's 4 inches a second. if I've done that right, 0.22 miles an hour. That's pretty slow. But believe it or not, we can actually detect motion that small. It's super challenging, and we haven't quite gotten there yet for astronomical sources, but in the laboratory, we can measure really small changes. With certain laboratory Doppler radar systems, I can see my motion of me wandering back and forth and waving my arms would show up as a distinctive Doppler signature. Now, that's me in the room with as much signal as I want on the Doppler radar gun. Doing with stars is very challenging, but we're almost there. The slowest speeds we've been able to reliably measure using these Doppler techniques from telescopes has just gotten down to about 90 centimeters per second. So we're getting close. We've got to get to 10. It's going to be really stinking hard, because at that point, you're at the level of literally weather and wobbling and oscillations in the atmosphere of the star itself, right? We're looking at the star's atmosphere, and it's got upwelling and all kinds of stuff going on. So it's going to be really hard to dig these signals out, but we're getting there. So we need to measure it with really high precision. The current state of the art has just dropped below 1 meter per second. So the techniques of radial velocities are not going to be able to work for Earth planets yet. They are working right now very well for bigger planets, kind of getting up to Neptune size, Neptune and Uranus size planets. And in fact, we're starting to find a lot of such things. 1995 was the breakthrough year. Okay, before 1995, we knew of exactly one solar system, ours. But in 1995, Michel Mayor and Didier Queoz, who were a pair of Swiss astronomers working at the Geneva Observatory, were some of the pioneers in the use of this Doppler technique. They began to survey nearby sun-like stars looking for the Doppler wobble signature. The very first star they found, which showed a distinctive Doppler wobble signature of a planet orbiting that star, was a star named 51 Pegasi, 40 light years away in the direction of the constellation of Pegasus. The orbital speed of that star was 56 meters per second. That's pretty big. Remember that for Jupiter, we were looking for 13 meters a second. So that's 56 meters a second. That's four times larger, a little bit more than four times larger than the motion imposed upon the Sun by Jupiter. But the other surprise was the orbital period. Jupiter takes 11.2 years to go around the Sun. This planet goes around every 4.25 days. This is a giant planet. In fact, it's a half Jupiter mass planet, only 0.05 of an astronomical unit from the parent star. It's the first discovery of a brand new class of planets we call hot Jupiters. Total surprise. A gas giant supposed to be out in the cold parts of the solar system, not up close and personal to its parent star. This sort of thing sort of caused everyone great conniption fits, because it just didn't fit. That's what happens in science. We have an idea of what things are like, and the nature basically shows us what it is. And this has been tremendously challenging. So these techniques are very sensitive to big planets close to their stars. There's a lot more diversity among stellar systems than we thought. We'll talk about that in detail on Monday, but I'll just drop that out there as something to think about. So this technique worked. In 1995, we suddenly went from one solar system to two, but the new one was pretty weird. And then they started coming one every couple months. By now, most of the planets that have been discovered have been through this radial velocities method. Many hundreds. I've actually decided to stop counting after a while because it's just too overwhelming. I think the number is pretty close to 500 planetary systems have been found through the radial velocity method. They're surveying now thousands of stars. This is an industry. They're just cranking them out. And we let the Exoplanet Encyclopedia guys keep that up on their website because I just stopped looking. So here it is. There actually were a couple of detections early on, but 1995 is the first few planets found here. Actually, it was earlier. They actually found the first data in 94. There's 51 Pegasi. And then from there, all they go. Now, there were some earlier detections, which were pretty crude. This is a star that actually was detected as early as 1989, but the data were so ratty, nobody believed it. But as the techniques got better, they went back and confirmed it, and so they get credit for being the first RV planet, but it's kind of a retro confirmation. The first real planet is down here at 51 Peg. This oddball here is a planet around a pulsar, a rapidly rotating neutron star. I couldn't make it get off the plot, so we'll just ignore that. So you start out with the first couple, and you got them kind of one a year, and now the points are all falling on top of each other. This is up to February 14th of 2012. And there's just a huge number of these things. Now, there's two lines on here that should be of interest. There's also going to be some transiting planets and other things are falling on here. This line is Earth mass. Okay, Jupiter mass is right up here. These are planet masses and units of the mass of Jupiter. And remember, Jupiter is about 318 times the mass of the Earth. This line here is, remember, as the planet gets lower and lower mass, you've got to wait a longer and longer time. Your accuracy has got to get better, and you've got to wait a longer time to see things. So we're seeing this sort of growth of being able to see smaller and smaller mass things. And we're just starting to cross the line. Around the year 2010, our techniques reach the point that they should start becoming sensitive to Earth mass planets. But not Earths in Earth orbits, but Earths in at least close-up orbit. So that's what we're seeing here is the progression of the technique. We should have had objects out here. This is the year of discovery. This is what it looks like. So the state of the art in this technique is we've gotten below 1 meter per second. 1 meter per second is this fast, me walking across the room, one pace per second, roughly 1 meter per second. So that's the level at which I can see a star moving back and forth because of the gravity of its planet. And we're just starting to, but not quite reaching, the sensitivity to detect Earths by the radial velocity technique. That's the big hope, because the big deal with radial velocities is if you can get the details out of the size of the planet, you can measure the planet's mass. And that's the real sort of holy grail of the problem, is measuring the mass. So radial velocities is a big deal. Most of the planets we've flown have been found by this. We're very sensitive to big planets, Jupiters, but we're starting to get some sensitivity in the measurements to Earths. The other indirect method is to use this planetary transit method. The fact that a planet, if we're perfectly lined up with the orbit, which only happens in rare circumstances, the planet will actually block some of the starlight out. As a consequence, when the planet is traveling or transiting the surface of the star as seen from the distance, the brightness of the star will be seen to dip and then recover in a characteristic way as the star passes across the disk of the different distant star. This obviously requires a great deal of precision. I don't know if you can read the numbers here, but this particular planet has a 16% dip. That's a big one. We're now getting down to fraction of a percent dips, thousandths of a percent that we're now sensitive to with new techniques. To date, 193 transiting systems are known. Some of them were first detected by radial velocities, and people took a bet and said, well, let's see if that's one doing like this, or is it doing it like this? And in a couple of cases, things were lined up. In fact, this is a picture of the very first of the transiting systems discovered, HD 209458. I do know that one because it's so famous. Was discovered first by radial velocities and then confirmed with transits. There are now a larger class of transiting planets that are discovered as transiting planets, and then they do radial velocity follow-up to try to measure the mass. So here's a little movie, got to kind of wait for it now, of how this works for two different types of planets. A Jupiter mass planet, which has a radius of 1/10 the radius of the Sun for Jupiter, and an Earth mass planet, which is 1/100. So you can see a Jupiter-sized planet crossing its disk. And if you look carefully, come on again, you'll see, entering right there, an Earth mass planet. You can see that the Jupiter covers a very large fraction of the parent star, so the transit depth is about a 1% dip. The star goes from 100% brightness to a maximum depth of 99% and then recovers during the transit. What makes Earth so challenging is it becomes a 0.01%, or 1,000 times less than this. So I've got to have truly absurd precision, a part in 10 to the 4, or preferably a part in 100,000 ability to measure the brightness of the star to high precision. There's lots of ways in which you can do that, but you really, this is the ones you want. The Jupiters we found a lot of. We can do that from the ground relatively easily. But finding those little dudes, that's going to be hard. The reason is because we're looking up through an atmosphere that's got a lot of junk in it. It's really hard to do this. So the answer is we've got to get out of the atmosphere and go into space. And that's what the Kepler mission is for. Most of the transiting planets have been found to date by the highest precision transit search around, which is due to the Kepler spacecraft. It was launched in 2008, put into a very high orbit. it's staring at millions of stars in a particular field up near the constellation of Cygnus, and just measuring to extremely high precision the brightnesses of all the stars. Occasionally, one of them is going to eclipse, or go into this transit. Some of them are because they're binary stars that eclipse. In fact, it's finding a ridiculous number of those. Kepler is uncovering an amazing number of systems. It's found planets, it's found binary stars, it's found some wacky triple star systems. It's found some things that are so strange we don't really know what they are yet. Kepler is just an amazing goldmine of data. But there's a subset that Kepler is finding that are actually planetary systems. It's found more than 100 really good confirmed planetary systems to date. It's got in the background, waiting for confirmatory observations, nearly 2,000 candidates. What Kepler's designed to do is that super high precision to find an Earth in the habitable zone of a G, F, K, or M star. That's really going to be hard and challenging. It also means the orbit's going to be slow. You're going to see over the 3, 4, 5 year lifetime of the mission, only 4 or 5 transits. Remember, it takes the Earth, only goes around the sun once a year. So if you watched a star with our sun from a distant position, in line with the orbit of the Earth, you would see one eclipse per year, one little tiny transit dip. And that transit dip would be a drop in brightness of one part in 10,000 of the brightness of the star. So you've got to maintain high precision for a long time. And Kepler's starting to deliver. They're not there yet, but they're getting really, really close. In fact, they're starting to close in on Earth-sized planets, and as we'll see on Monday, Kepler's discovered the first sub-Earth-sized planets, although they're hot planets. They're not in the habitable zone. But they're getting real close. Any day now, any year now, we're going to learn about the first Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone of its parent star. I would not have believed that 10 years ago. I actually think it's just a matter of days, or a matter of weeks, or hours, or months, when they actually get the confirmation of a real Earth-sized planet in its habitable zone. That's going to be exciting stuff. So those are those indirect methods. Now let's go into a somewhat wackier method. Gravitational microlensing occurs, it's predicted by Albert Einstein, when two stars almost perfectly line up on the sky. So I got a background star here, a little red star, and a foreground yellow star. As the light comes from the red star, it has to get to the Earth, it has to pass around this nearby star, and the light that normally would have shown off in these directions gets bent by the gravity of that star and actually arrives at Earth. The foreground star acts like a gravitational lens, magnifying the light from the background star. Now, of course, you say, well, how do you know that that star is magnified? And the answer is the stars aren't just sitting still, they're moving. So as this star moves across the background relative to the star, what I will see is I'll get maximum magnification followed by demagnification. So I go out to normal brightness and I magnify during a very brief interval that I'm exactly lined up on a line between the Earth, the foreground star, and the background star. And you get this brief brightening as the foreground star and the background star just pass into alignment with each other. That brief magnification can be quite dramatic. There are some of the stars we've seen do this that have more than a factor of 1,000 magnification. That's an almost perfect lineup. Most stars are an imperfect lineup. This particular star amplified by only a factor of 3. But we see amplifications of many hundreds. Of course, the problem with this is I have to look at a lot of stars to get this chance alignment, many millions of stars, to see maybe a couple hundred, now up to about 1,000 per year. So far, so good. Okay, we can find these things. Gravitational lensing has been demonstrated. But why is it interesting to us? Well, I've drawn this lensing star all by itself. But what if that lensing star has a planet around it? Well, the planet's gravity is also going to make a little lens. But it's a smaller lens than the big lens due to the star. And so what happens is, if you have a planet around that star, this is the curve, the brightening curve. You're faint, you're maximally magnified, and then fainter for a single star all by its lonesome as the lensing star. But if that lensing star has a planet, you'll get the same amplification pattern, but when the background star passes between us and the planet, boop, I get a little blip due to the gravity of that star. And the parameters of this blip actually tell you the mass ratio, so you can measure the mass. Now, this is a method that's been invented by OSU astronomer Andy Gould. He has been working on this for many years. His student, Scott Gowdy, who's now on our faculty, has really developed this into a very, very high art. So far, and I see I've got a little old here, actually we've got up to 12 planets now. 9 is fully confirmed, but we got another couple in our back pockets waiting to be published here. We found about 9 planets for sure this way. We do this with not just simply a single telescope, but a whole network of telescopes down in the southern hemisphere. The biggest concentration of stars in our galaxy is towards our galactic bulge. There's millions of stars within a few degree patches. There's a series of telescopes, one run by a Polish group of astronomers from South America and Chile, another group run by a New Zealand-Japanese collaboration on the island of New Zealand called MOA, which stares at a particular patch of our galactic bulge and identifies these sudden brightenings of a microlensing event. And then our network, consisting of small professional telescopes and a network of now nearly 24 amateur astronomers with 10 and 12-inch telescopes outfitted with modern digital detectors, courtesy of NASA and us, who then swing into action and can watch this. They're spread out all around the southern hemisphere. We've got a station in Tahiti, South Africa, Chile, Australia, New Zealand, as much as we can cover the southern hemisphere where the bulge is up all night. Someone will have bad weather, someone will have good weather. And we actually set up a microlensing follow-up network, or what we like to call MicroFun for short. We've been operating for a number of years, and we've had a couple big scores. Here's one of them. Here's what one of these microlensing events looks like when you take that simple magnification pattern and you put planets around it. In this case, this is Ogul 2006-109 BC, kind of a boring name, but it's what we call it, is actually a two-planet system. It's a Jupiter-sized and Saturn-sized planet in the same position in the orbit around the parent star, which is a small K-star, as Jupiter and Saturn are around our sun. It is the very first solar system analog. The primary measurements here are all the sites, were made by amateurs who own telescopes in their backyard. They're super dedicated. In fact, they do better than the professionals sometimes because they actually seem to pay attention to their craft. The primary measurements, to give you an example of who's involved in this, is a New Zealand woman who is a single mother who works a day job and who has actually contributed to 8 of the 12 planets we've discovered to date with the MicroFun network. A few years ago, she was actually named one step below a knighthood in New Zealand on the Queen's birthday, given a very high national honor to a person who has no college education but is extremely dedicated. Jenny is awesome. She's really good. She actually contacted us. That's how we learned about this. That's the kind of dedication that goes into this. So we've been able to discover another dozen planets. Why do we care? Well, the reason we care is those radial velocity and transit methods are most sensitive to planets close to their parent stars. They're finding all the wacky solar systems, the things with Jupiters where they shouldn't be. There's a Jupiter and Saturn where we think they should be. We're refining these techniques, and we're getting down to the point that in a couple of years, we're going to be sensitive to Earths in Earth-like orbits. Now, we're probably not going to find systems that are going to be visible, meaning that we can go out and image them and do spectra and look for life signs, but we're looking at a huge section of our galaxy, so we get a huge number of candidates. We're going to start learning the demographics of these planets. How often is an Earth-like planet found in the habitable zone of its parent star? That's sometimes as important as the discovery is understanding what the populations of planets are. What is the census of planets in our galaxy? We're never going to be able to count every planet, but if I can statistically work out what that fraction is, I can now begin to sensibly address the question of how often might life have arisen in our galaxy, and then maybe address the question of how often did intelligent life arise in our galaxy. That used to be the area of pure science fiction speculation. In about a decade, we're going to hang some hard numbers on that. So what we're getting so far? To date, all of these techniques combined have discovered 760 planets around 609 stars. By the end of this class, I expect that number to go up by a few tens, perhaps. A large number of these have been multiple planet systems. A lot are single planets. A lot of them are Jupiter mass planets. We've even gotten down increasingly to Neptune mass planets and so-called super-Earths, things that are 2 or 3 times the mass of the Earth. But what's really exciting is in the last few months, just in the last few months, we've started to find Earth and smaller planets. We're just finally broke through that barrier where we're finding things that look like the Earth in size. What we've not found yet is something in the habitable zone. So there's the techniques. What are the discoveries? That's what we're going to talk about starting on Monday.